Okay, hi Tim, how are you going?
I'm very well, thank you, Pato. How are you?
Yeah, great, thanks. Congratulations on your win at Murrumweena.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, it was a pretty exciting weekend.
Yeah, it sure was. How long ago did you lock in that race?
So initially after Biggs, I was looking at what events I could do just to kind of like I thought 60 was kind of be enough for the Australian team. So I thought, oh, I don't need to do too many. But then so I was going to do MVP, and then I was looking at maybe No Time to Die as well. And then after a few message chats with yourself and Ben Nichols and everyone else, it sounded like the party was going to be at Murrumweena. And I'm like, oh, damn it. Like, I really want to go somewhere where I can be, tested again. I kind of felt like I had a little bit of unfinished business from Biggs. So that's where I scrapped the idea of MVP and then, kind of focused on Murrumweena.
Yeah. And what about Ollie? Did he lock in Murrumweena when you decided to as well, or was he always going to run it?
Yeah, so I pretty much signed him up at the same time. He had the Yu Yang's 50K, and things didn't kind of go planned for him there, and he was kind of spewing about that, and then so we kind of looked at what other events were around, and I thought, well, Murrumweena, although it's a tough backyard ultra, it might be a good one for him to kind of have another go at. So so we kind of signed up at the same time.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, like the Australian team's running later this year in October. A lot of people would already know this, but there's 15 runners in the team. 10 of them are made up from the at-large list, and the other five are silver tickets. So you were sitting in sixth spot on the at-large list with 60 yards, but now you've got that silver ticket. It must be a nice feeling knowing you can just sit back and not have to worry about getting knocked off that list.
Yeah, that was kind of my goal going into it. Like I kind of after Biggs, I kind of thought, like the reason why I felt like I didn't really go further in Biggs was mainly because I kind of didn't have a real purpose of, or a kind of drive or a goal at Biggs. Whereas this time around, I've kind of gone into my events going, I want to win, like. I really want to win. I want to do the best that I can, and I'm not going to stop until I'm really done. And then knowing that for Biggs, I couldn't take my family to Biggs because I got the call up last minute. I thought, you know what, I'm not going to take that risk again because I remember last year watching the at large list. It would just be shuffling around, and I thought, oh, you know what. I'm probably sixth on the list at that time, and I'm like, I've got a good chance of getting in here. Six people might drop out, and then next minute, the Polish guys all get three of them get like 60 plus, and I'm like, I'm done. Like, I'll bounce down the list three, and then I think the French guys had four of them hit 60 and stop on 60 as well, and I'm like, you know what? This changes so quickly, so there's no reason why. It can't happen in Australia either. Like we've got Hurdies coming up today, and you've got 400 runners. And I know that guys like Johan, Michael Bellman, all those guys, they're all capable of going 60 plus. And all it takes is that right mindset, and they get to team up together. And next minute you're getting bumped down to at least four or five, and then you're kind of scrambling to find an event to qualify. So I didn't want that to happen again. So hence, getting that silver ticket's kind of got that one thing off my mind, and now I can make sure that, my family can come across and watch and support me over in WA.
Yeah, and it's like 2 years ago with the Australian team, no one even knew about what numbers they had to hit to make the at-large list. But now everyone has a number in mind, so it's going to be really competitive, I think. And I think 60 probably would have been enough to get you in, but you just don't know, really.
No, you don't know. And it's because everyone's so keen to make it as well. Like on Strava, I'll have a look, I'll be looking at other people's training and seeing, you know, what my competitors have been doing. And some people, their training has just gone to an elite level. So I don't train, I train and I don't worry about what anyone else is doing, but I try and have a lot of respect for the people that are putting in, because I'm like, you know what? I've got to make sure that I've put in enough, because these guys are putting in a hell of a lot as well. So I think as a community and as a, you know, as a team in Australia, everyone's kind of putting in so much more. You know, where people used to do, you know, 70, 80K weeks, these people are putting in 120, 150K weeks. Yeah. And it's just like, I mean, yeah, it's a hell of a lot more. So it's becoming quite elite in terms of the training that I'm seeing anyway.
Yeah, sure. So with Miriam Wernert, I guess the first thing to talk about is the actual course itself. And this isn't like your average run-of-the-mill backyard ultra course, is it?
No, not at all. After running Biggs, I didn't think that there'd be a course that could be worse than running Biggs, especially the day loop. At Biggs, there was a, you know, a defined trail at Biggs, but it was very rocky. There was a lot of little roots and stuff across the track. Whereas at Miriam Wernert, there were places where there was like tussock grass and there was a rock directly behind it. And like, I rolled my ankle so many times at Miriam Wernert. Luckily, I kind of took a different approach, similar to Biggs, where I would short step like my stride on the day loop, just so that if I did roll it, there wasn't as much impact going through, and it was more of a little tweak or that's a bit dangerous, got to be careful of that. But you just had to be switched on during the day loop, so the whole time. And even what seemed like on your elevation map, what might have been flat, like there was twigs across the ground. And you know, those ones, it was funny, I was talking to Joel last night about it. There was like, there'd be like a branch, and it's those type of branches that you kick it with one foot, it gets stuck between the other one, and then it gets stuck between your legs, and you're like, what the hell's going on? So there was a lot of that going on. So you're constantly looking and at what's going at your feet. But even like coming down some of the hills, it's one thing coming straight down the hill, but running across a hill with that kind of gradient, it was just your feet were getting pushed to the side constantly. So there were, like, you know, places where I would not normally have hot spots on my feet, they were starting to develop. I found myself taping my feet a few extra times in places just to stop that happening. So it was really difficult. And then you had that hill, that right in that back paddock, you had the hill where you, it was just a march up that hill. So it was tough. And like, I found myself, normally I wouldn't run as much at the start of a loop or at the end of a loop, but you had to take advantage of the two easier sections in that front paddock so that you can make up the time in that back paddock.
You really couldn't look up. You had to look where you're putting your feet the whole time, didn't you?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I remember Peter Clark was out on course, and I was like concentrating where I was putting my feet, and he goes, oh, look over there, there's some kangaroos. And I really wanted to look up and have a look, but I just couldn't, because I knew I'd trip over if I tried.
Yeah, well, the exact same thing happened at Biggs. There was some of the European supporters would be out on course, and you know what the European supporters are like, they're so passionate about running and they're cheering and yell. And, you know, you want to look up and like thank them for their, you know, support, but it's like, no, you got to look down. Same thing here. It's like the one moment you look up, it's the time that you'll go over. But like, I even had a few moments where I kick a rock, I Superman into the dirt about two or three times. Luckily, I didn't do any damage, but there are a lot of times there that the course was, it wasn't great in comparison to the night anyway.
Yeah, sure. So leading into the race, everyone was looking at the long range weather forecast, and everyone knew it was going to be hot, but as we got closer and closer to the actual date of the race, it was the forecast kept getting hotter and hotter. So I mean, at least it gave us some time to prepare for the heat and figure out what we were going to do to combat it. But what were your main strategies at beating the heat?
Well, yeah, so I had a few things in mind for the heat. Like, you're right, looking at the long range forecast, it looked okay. It looked like it was going to be just one hot day, and then the others were going to be in the mid to low 20s. And so I thought, oh yeah, you know, one hot day, you know, that would probably come forward because they normally get it wrong. The Friday will be hot, and then the Saturday it'll be okay. And then yeah, it got worse. Like, I couldn't believe that it was, at one point I was seeing 40 degrees on the Saturday, it was like 38 on the Sunday, and then 35 on the Monday, and I'm like, I'm gonna have to run till Tuesday, Wednesday before I get relief. And even the overnight temps being 27, I'm like, oh, how are we gonna do this in, you know, there is no relief. But I also, my main concern was that running with Ollie, I'm like, I need to make sure that he's okay. So I'm not sure if you remember last year I did a Deakin study into hyperhydration. In hot temperatures.
Yeah.
And so I dug up that study, the findings of that study, and what it ended up, that was for me, that was probably what got me through that first day. So a lot of those findings were around using salt to hyperhydrate the morning of and things like that. So me and Ollie were kind of on a little bit of a protocol of that in the morning, which was like, you know, making sure we had salt every single hour. I had some Gatorade. So we were super hydrated. Because in that study, what ended up happening was I in the control group, we consumed like 1.7 liters of fluid over 3 hours, and in the control group I retained minus 150 mil.
Right.
So I was actually, I had less because I obviously hadn't had any the salt and the glycerol and stuff like that. But on the following time, I actually retained 1.1 liters of fluid. And my half marathon time was 10 minutes faster than what it was in the previous time. And we ran in like a 35 degree heat on both those days. So I thought, you know what, I'll try that because obviously it worked there. I know that the Backyard Ultra is a lot longer distance, but it might get us through that first day so that we can kind of look after ourselves at night. So we kind of did that. We made sure that during the week we're well hydrated, had plenty of, you know, salts and things like that and minerals. So that was a big part of it. But also just getting good heat acclimation going into the event, like running in the middle of the day constantly. So that was probably, yeah, that's what kind of, I think that's what might have got us through just those first initial laps. And making sure that we were drinking heaps. Normally, I would drink, you know, maybe 500 mil of fluid an hour. We were probably going at 1.2 liters an hour. So it was hot. Don't get me wrong. We were all suffering out there, but I didn't feel like, I felt like we were doing enough in the breaks to rehydrate, get the core temperature down. And like, we had fans on us. So I reckon I overthought a lot, but I had to take Oliver's health into consideration more so. So that's probably why it looked, you see my setup, like I had a hell of a lot of things going on, but they were all kind of around making sure that Ollie was going to be safe in those conditions.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and was it the hottest race you reckon you've ever run in?
Yeah, oh, most definitely. I've never done anything in that kind of heat before. I was concerned. I was a little stressed going into the event. That was probably the only thing I was really stressed about going into the event. And you could feel it, like it was a relief. You kind of got to the top of the first hill the breeze would hit you and you'd be like, oh, this is such a relief. Yeah. And then you go back down into the valley and it was a K and a half in that valley and it was just, there was no wind and you could just feel the heat radiating off that paddy.
Yeah, it was pretty intense. And it didn't take long for runners to start dropping on that first day. It was off its head. Were you paying much attention to that kind of stuff, like all these runners dropping around you?
Yeah, I was actually sad every time. Yeah. I'm like, no way, Paddo, you're not, like when I seen you go, it broke my heart. I'm like, because I know how much effort everyone puts in. I see the training that everyone puts in on Strava and on, and it breaks your heart because, yeah. You know, it could be me. I take that on as, you know, what would I feel if I was dropping out, you know, in an event that I had so much hope for and things like that and something goes wrong. And so, yeah, it broke my heart when I seen you and then when I seen Ben and then I seen Matt, I'm like, oh, no, what's going on?
Yeah.
I knew it was hot, but I'm thinking, you know, if one of you's dropped out, I'll be like, okay, something's gone wrong, maybe a rolled ankle or something like that. But for everyone to start dropping so quickly, I was pretty concerned. And then I was also concerned for Ollie's headspace in regards to that as well.
Yeah.
Because, like, I'm looking at it and going, I'm feeling okay, I can keep going, I'm not going to drop. But then I didn't want Ollie to start looking at everyone else and going, they're dropping, you know, and that's very easy for him to kind of put two and two together and go, oh, maybe I'm not feeling as good as what I am.
So
it broke my heart every time I gave you guys a hug when I seen yous, and I'm like, oh, you could just feel it. Like, yeah, it's tough to watch your friends, you know, struggle like that, especially when their hopes and dreams are so big.
Yeah. And I was going to say, did seeing us all drop so early, did it also like make you even more hyper aware of how important like managing your hydration and managing the heat was?
Yeah, it did. Like, because every time I came in, I'm like, oh, you know, what happened? Like, what happened to Paddo? What happened? And they're like, oh, everyone's just been cooked. Everyone's just been cooked by the sun. And I'm like, okay. So I actually, like, I had my plan, my nutrition plan and everything like that. And for the first time ever, like a lot of it changed. I went from, instead of having salt caps every 4 hours during the day, it went to 2 hours. It went to focusing on looking ahead more. I was talking to my wife, who was my crew chief, and saying, you know, we're going to have to adjust for the night. We're not going to be able to, I didn't have a plan in place to take water with me at night. It was just going to be 500 mil. And I said, no, scrap that idea. We're going to have to take that out because we're going to have to, if we're going to go long, we're going to have to rehydrate at night, because that's probably the only break that we're going to have.
Yeah.
So a lot of that, yeah. So, yeah, I had to take all that into account, I suppose.
Because there was so much changing between, because it was such a type of race where you had to stay on top of so much stuff and also communicate with your crew about what was going on, that would have also made it a bit challenging as well, because, like, you're trying to rehydrate, cool down, communicate with your crew about race plan and everything like that. It was off its head.
Yeah, it was. Like, I was pretty grateful that I was pretty switched on. I had probably one lap where I kind of started hallucinating a little bit, but I was still kind of, you know, I knew what I was doing, but it did give you something to focus on as well. I find that as long as you've got something to focus on, you're still in it. So yeah, coming in and kind of having to pivot all the time, going, okay, we're not going to be able to have the noodles with broth because it's too hot. Yeah. Let's do our overnight oats. Let's do this. Let's do that. And I was constantly, kind of changing things on the fly, but also changing them for Ollie as well. Because I was kind of gauging what the conditions were doing to me. And I'm thinking, as a 15-year-old, they're probably going to be exacerbated a little bit. So let's make sure that he's okay as well. But I mean, we were coming in at points and it was just, I was almost having ice baths every single time. We had towels, like we had like a kiddie pool full of ice, and we had a towel that was just in, sunk in there. And that would be, I'd come in, lay back, and they would put that whole ice towel on me for the 5 or 6 minutes I was there, and it would just bring the core temperature right down. And then I just felt every, at the start of every loop, I actually felt fresh enough to go, oh, this is okay. And then by the time I kind of got back without 1.5 Ks to go, I was like, oh, I'm actually getting a little bit warm here again. And I found myself, you know, maybe sprinkling a little bit of water on myself. So I, in the end, I think I was taking like 500 mil of tailwind, 500 mil of water, and 250 mil of that water was actually used to cool myself down.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so, I mean, all while this was going on, well, that first day, Ollie, he was looking as strong as anyone in the race. Were you running together a lot or most of that first day?
Well, I think on that first day, I think we came in once together. I kind of, with Ollie, I kind of didn't want to impose on his race either. I wanted him to kind of experience it for himself and kind of enjoy, you know, building relationships with other people, running with them, seeing how other people run. Because the thing is that, like, I mean, we talk so much about, you know, racing and running and what works and what doesn't work. And the thing is that I don't believe I'm always right. So I wanted him to see what other runners do and how, you know, what methods they do to problem solve their way out of things. And at the start, it was really cool because I noticed that he was running a fair bit with Ben at the start. So, which is cool. He's got so much to learn from guys like Ben and yourself and even Dan Kamak. Ollie was running at him with him at the start of one night. So I think leaving him to be during the day course, which was pretty tricky because you couldn't, pace wise, we do run at a slightly different pace and it was single track. Yeah. So to run together, it was a little bit tricky. But I always said to him, I'll go, mate, if you need me at any point, just, you know, just yell out. And like, there was a few times I said to him, I go, mate, do you want to run together? And he'd be like, yeah, we'll run together. So we did a couple loops, I reckon day loops, on the first day together. But then when we hit the night, I kind of put in a strategy. I noticed that a lot of people were starting to struggle. And I thought, with Aaron and Johan in previous times, we've actually put like a run walk strategy in place just to help people out, just to kind of, you know, create a bit of a group. And myself and Josh, Dan for a little bit, Joel for a little bit as well, we kind of did a kind of strategy where we'd get to that top of that first big hill in about 6 minutes, and then we'd go 3 minutes run, 2 minute walk, 3 minutes run, 2 minute walk. And it kind of got us in about 49-50 minutes, which worked really well. And then I think for the first couple, Ollie kind of hung back a bit. But then I think when Josh dropped off us, it was me and Ollie for about 10 hours together, which was kind of, it was pretty special. Like, you know, I had a few down moments even on that first day, and he's there, got his headphones in, singing. And I'm like, this is pretty cool. Like, yeah. My son's been running for 100 kilometers and he's there with a, you know, positive attitude going, are you okay, Dad? You know, you'll be okay. And I'm like, oh, man, like, it's good. Like, I mean, I thought it was going to be all one way. I thought it was going to be me trying to motivate him. But then, yeah, because I was so focused on him and worried that you know, that how he was going, I kind of didn't worry about too much about myself. And then, yeah, then it hit, you know, in the middle of the night, you feel like crap a bit. And then next minute you've got your son going, you've got this, Dad. And then that'd pick you up. So it was pretty special.
Yeah. I think once nighttime came and Ollie was still in the race, I think everyone who was there watching, they realized they were watching something pretty special. And everyone's jaw was dropping lower and lower to the ground every loop Ollie completed. And I mean, You're Ollie's father, so I mean, you kind of know how he trains and how good of a runner he is. But were you, even you, a little bit surprised about how well he went?
Well, yeah. Well, when I we talk a lot about, like, you know, his hopes and dreams, and, you know, he's got this massive dream. He wants to make SAT champs and things like that. And, you know, I'm not one to say, oh, mate, you can't do it. And, you know, because he can. There's no reason why he can't. But I also always kind of encourage him to, you know, have realistic goals, because if you set your goals super, super high and, you know, you go into an event and say, for instance, he ran 22 hours, and to make the Australian team, you need 50, you can kind of get sucked into a little bit of being a little bit disappointed in your achievements. And I said to him, I go, you know, you've got to be super proud of, you know, what you put out there, and what you achieved is amazing. Every time it's amazing, you know, so don't, you know, that might be your ultimate goal, and you'll get there, and you've got to just, you know, take pride in where you got to. In terms of his, like, training and what he does, he's a super determined kid. And you know what it's like, you know, we speak about, you know, these massive distances, and we're, you know, doing events every 6 weeks, and you kind of get stuck in a bubble. And it's, you know, the people outside of that bubble will always look at it and go, oh my God, that's huge what they've done, what you've done. But you sometimes don't realize yourself, because everyone that you're friends with is doing the same thing. Yeah. So, yeah, so I do try and take a breath and say to him, mate, you've just ran almost 160 kilometers. You're 15 years old. I remember, you know, running at school doing cross country 3 kilometers and thinking that's the longest distance on the planet, you know, and he's been running for 22 hours. So yeah, I mean, he's now talking to him, he is a little bit disappointed that he stopped. But I'm like, how can you be disappointed, mate? But that's the nature of the backyard ultra, isn't it? Like, you always think you could have given a little bit more if you had to change something. But I mean, in terms of his training, it's pretty phenomenal. Like, he was doing 100 kilometer weeks and stuff like that. But the last month leading into the race, we tried to back it right off. Try to introduce some cross training and things like that, because I'm always concerned that he's going to burn himself out. So we've got to try and, you know, make sure that doesn't happen. And like, yeah, he's a pretty accountable kid. So I'm pretty proud of, you know, what he achieved. It was just phenomenal. Like, and when he pulled out, the fact that he finished that last loop, and I knew that he didn't hit that corner, in time to finish that loop, and then I had to start that loop, and it hurts, because it's like, I just want to stop and I just want to be with him, but then I'm out of the race if I stop.
Yeah.
But yeah, you would have seen that video where we kind of seen each other, and I gave him a hug, and I was so proud of him. Like, it was a pretty amazing moment. Like, that whole kilometer and a half to get to him, I was in tears, because I couldn't believe that he'd achieved so much.
Yeah, sure. I was going to say, like, you both made it through the first night. You both made it through to the 2-2 loop. So on that 23rd yard, you must have known sometime during that yard that Ollie was struggling. But it must have been tough for you to have to keep on running and leave him behind.
Yeah, It was, at the end of the day, like, I knew that there'd come a point where I'd have to leave him.
Yeah.
And I think that's the hardest thing. It's almost like we sometimes speak about, like, Ollie will say to me, oh, Dad, you know, if it was just me and you left, you know, what would you do? And I'm like, well, I'd keep running, mate. And he's like, so you wouldn't let me win, because I don't want you to let me win. I don't want you to let me win. I'm like, mate, there is no chance I'm going to let you win, right? Because you would learn absolutely nothing if I gave it to you, right? I want you to beat me and be able to say, oh, Dad, I beat you. And I'm going to say, yeah, mate, you beat me fair and square. And because you'll learn more from that. So, As hard as it is having to do that, because it's almost one of the hardest things as a parent to do, you know, to watch your child not fail, but to not help them when you know you could have.
Yeah.
But just having that understanding that that's where they're going to have all their, that's where they're going to learn from. So on that day, Loop, we kind of spoke when we went out, and I said to him, I'm like, you know, are you going to be okay, you know, running on your own? And he's like, yeah, I'll be fine. I thought he might have got to the 24, but I also knew that it getting so close and having that understanding of, you know, when there's a milestone coming up, there's so many times in events where I'm like, oh, there's a milestone coming up. At Biggs, for me, it was when my PB was coming up. Those four loops were the toughest loops because I knew my PB was coming up. Or for him, I knew that 24 hours was going to come up. And, you know, not getting to 24 was probably the best thing that happened to him, because now when that moment comes, he'll go, I'm not going to let that happen again. You know, I really want that 24 hours. So I think that there was more for him to learn from that experience than if he had have got 24.
Yeah. You would have seen the video and you would have been told the reception he got when he came back. It was awesome.
Yeah, I did. I was spewing. I wasn't there for it. Right. Yeah. And it's amazing. Like everyone was in awe of what he achieved. Like even if it hadn't have been, you know, 35 plus degrees every day, everyone would have been in awe that he'd managed 22 loops on that tough course.
Yeah.
So it was it was pretty amazing just to see him get through that heat. He had every excuse, and that's the thing. We spoke about it. I said to him, okay, mate, you had every excuse to pull out early. It was hot, it was a super tough course. You had guys that have been on the Australian team that struggled. You had guys that have got PBs well and truly more than what you have, and they struggled, and you made it through. So, you know, take pride in not that you beat those guys, but that you managed the conditions really well, and that, you know, your future, your trajectory is in an upward direction, you know.
Yeah, that video you mentioned, the one where you ran past him and gave him a hug and stuff, it was really cool as well, because you see the other runners stop and interact with him a little bit. And I thought Ross McPhee summed it up the best when he said that what Ollie did was the best thing that happened at the event by a mile.
Oh, for sure. Ross is the gentleman of backyard ultras. I so hope that he manages to get onto the Australian team, because he's like he would be the flag bearer of our team, Ross would. He's one of those guys that no matter what, you can kind of, if you're struggling, Ross is the guy that you want to, you know, back off and run with him for a little bit. He'll pick you up. He's an amazing guy. He was like a proud dad as well, watching Ollie do those loops. He was so, so proud of him, and it was, yeah, it was good to see on that video. Yeah, when he got up, come up to him and gave him a hug, and even Ross, even Ollie was saying that, yeah, you know, Ross was amazing throughout the whole thing, and I think that Ollie did a fair few loops with him as well, so which was cool.
Yeah. So at the 24-hour mark, there was five runners left. There was you, Lockie Danzy, Christy Lambert, Ross McPhee, and Dan Carmack. So I guess the first question is, how were you feeling at the 24-hour mark?
Well, I'd kind of, you know, when I'd seen Ollie on that 23rd loop and gave him a hug and stuff like that, and we had shared a moment together, it was pretty cool. At that moment, like, I ran the rest of that loop and I'm like, there is no way I'm going to lose this event. I knew at that time that there was no way I was going to lose, because I thought, if my son can do that, then there is no way I could lose. I'm going to have to, not going to have to, but I'm going to win it. Just going off his energy that he put out there and what he gave, that it would be, you know, a dishonor to him to not give the same amount. So at around that, yeah, so at about 24 hours, I'm like, no, this is okay. Going back to, you know, let's manage how this is going. I felt like it got hotter and hotter as the day went on. But I, when I'd come back, I spoke to Rachel, my wife, and I said to her, I'm like, look, we're going to have to cool me down every single time. And then I think it was around about 24 or 25 hours where I came in, and that's when the whole ice towel thing began. So it was just ice all over me, towel all over my head. I was just taking in heaps of fluids. And then I think I went out on the next loop and I come in and I said exactly the same. Let's just repeat that, because I actually felt pretty good on that loop. So in terms of body management, I felt like we'd kind of gotten on top of it, because the first day I found my heart rate spiking to about 160 at times in the back paddock walking. And I'm like, oh, okay, I'm working way too hard. And then I noticed on the second day at the same times, I managed to keep it at about 130 to 135, even running at like in the hotter parts. So I'm like, okay, my heart rate's down. This is good. I'm managing this. And I just felt like it was hot, but I was managing it.
Yeah, awesome. And of those four runners remaining, did you have a sense of who you thought would be sticking around for the longest?
Yeah, physically, what I seen physically, Lockie looked like he was going to be the strongest out of everyone. I reckon out of every five loops, he'd probably be finishing three or four in front of me, and then I'd finish the odd one in front of him. Dan, I knew that Dan and Ross had plenty in them. I know that they've gone far, and that's always in the back of your head. You know their PBs, and you know that they're capable of going 2 days. I wasn't aware of how they were managing their body in terms of the heat or anything like that. And Chrissy, she was a beast out there. There were moments there I'm thinking, I think it's going to just be me and her. Like, she was so quick on loops. She was super comfortable. Her form, every time I seen her form was super strong. She finished, I think, on that first night, every single night loop, she finished in front of me. And she was just comfortable. Like, she just shuffling along the whole time, straight past. And she was, she wasn't having any problems. I was speaking to Lockie a few times, and I don't know whether, like, physically he probably could have kept on going, but I think just mentally, maybe knowing that, like, after talking to me, I said, oh, well, you know, we're not even halfway, Lockie, like, to 60. And I said to him, I go, I want to see if we can get as many, you know, Victorians on the Aussie team as we possibly can, knowing that Ross was still in. So I don't know. I think physically he could have definitely kept on going, but, you know, there's a big difference between running for 24 hours and 48 hours. So you don't know, you know, how they'd be traveling. But Dan, again, he's a solid runner. Me and him both ran in the heat at Hurdy's last year, both getting 51 loops. And I don't know how he runs in a long sleeve top, but he did it, and he looked like calm, cool and collected the whole time. And he was consistent. His laps were consistent. So there was nothing to, like, we would pass each other, just at that, you know, with about 1.5 k's to go on that fence line every time, would give each other, you know, a thumbs up, you know, good form, keep going. And it looked like that was going to carry on forever. So I was prepared for the long haul, you know, against him. So I thought that he probably had the best chance of going far, with Lockie kind of physically being able to, but I don't know whether his heart was in it as much as the other guys.
Yeah. He was bloody impressive, Lockie. Like, he beat the other Search for Hurt contestants easily, and he looked like you said, he was coming first on nearly all those loops, and he looked so comfortable.
Yeah, he did. And he's got, I mean, he's got a good, you know, athletic background as well. 10 or 12 years ago, I used to race against him in obstacle racing, and I looked up to him. I thought he was one of my idols. I thought, man, I want to be like this guy. He was just, you know, his poker face is amazing. You wouldn't even know that he's hurting. He's just pumping out yard after yard after yard, and he just looked smooth. He was running around in a singlet, and he was all tanned up, and yeah. I'm like, he's just got that X factor in terms of, yeah, being able to just run all day. Even his last loop was half an hour or whatever it was. So you knew that he had more in him, but you know what it's like the physical side of a backyard ultra is only that a tiny little part. It's the mental side of it. It does, you know, it wears you down. There's moments. I remember Ollie even saying to me at one point, I think it was like 21 or 22 yards. He's like, I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah.
It's like, I just don't want to do this anymore. And now we talk about it. He goes, I don't know why I even said that. But you know, that's what happens. You know, it grinds you down to a point where you're like, what am I doing this for? Because, yeah. So I think that's where the mental side of it comes in. And you know, I'd love to, you know, to see Lockie, you know, be prepared and want to go as far as he possibly can, because I think that he'd be a massive asset to our Australian team. Whether he, you know, has the time to invest in it, I'm not sure. But, yeah, he was definitely one of the strongest out there.
Yeah. Do you know what ended it for Dan Carmack at the end?
I think in the end, we kind of spoke about it. I think he kind of he just slowed to a pace where he just wasn't going to make it back. I thought – I was actually – like with two loops to go on the day loop, I thought that it was going to be over. I thought, he's slowed down a fair bit. And I think that might have been like loop 32. I kind of took off a little bit faster because I'm like, all right, I just want to get through these day loops, cool off and get ready for the night loops. And I thought that I was far enough ahead of him that, you know, he might look up and go, oh, you know, there's no catching Tim or whatever. And I turned around, and he was right there in the back paddock. And I'm like, oh no, this is going to go a lot further than what I thought. And then I think on that second half of that loop, he dropped off a little bit. And then he'd come in like 55 or 56 minutes and he kind of didn't have enough time. And it was kind of reminiscent of what happened to me in at Biggs, where there was the last two day loops were really tough, and I found myself pushing because the night loop was so close. I just really wanted to make sure I got there, and then when I finally got there, I was too cooked to do too much in that night loop. So I don't know whether he'd kind of pushed too hard in those last few loops to get to that. Once he got to the night loop, because it's hard. Once that lactic acid starts building up and you don't have that 10 minutes or so to flush things out and things like that, you start to seize up the dehydration, the amount that you've sweated on those last couple of loops. I wish he had gone further because, you know, I was prepared to go to a point where, you know, to qualify him for SAT champs, but I think if it hadn't been for the weather, I think that a lot of guys, we would have gone a hell of a lot deeper, because there was some strong bodies there that made it to 35, made into the 30s, that, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's actually not that big a total, but under the conditions that we had, I felt it was probably maybe an extra 10 or 15 loops worth of effort.
Yeah, sure. And I was going to say, like, I mean, you ran 35 yards, which is nowhere near your PB, but it was an awesome performance. And I was wondering, like, if you'd rank it as your best performance?
The way I finished, I felt really strong I felt like I'd I felt like I dialed in everything. Like my training was, I did a fair bit of training going into this to make sure that, you know, all the boxes were ticked. I wouldn't say that it was my best performance because I just felt like I had so much more to kind of give. But I felt like I had an opportunity though this time to help others, which was really, really nice. Every other time I've focused so much on my own performance, because I sometimes look at some of the other runners that I've raced against, and I look at guys like Rob Parsons and guys like Aaron. Like, I watch Aaron pick people up and just drag them along for hours on end so that they can achieve what they need to achieve and then still manage to get, you know, awesome results for himself. And I kind of wanted to kind of channel that a little bit more. You know, with Ollie, I got that opportunity throughout the whole night. A friend of mine, Josh, there were times there where, you know, he looked pretty cooked as well. And we kind of went, come on, you know, stick with us for a little bit just to kind of push him on. And I'm spewing, I didn't get that opportunity to do it with Dan at the end. But, you know, I think that, like, with the weather being so hot and those last couple of loops, I was just kind of had to refocus to make sure that I could get to the night myself. So it was a pretty cool opportunity to be able to do that. But in terms of, my best physical performance, maybe not so much, but in how I felt about, you know, being able to share it with Ollie, most definitely.
Yeah. Talking about Aaron Young, about how great he is with, like, helping others in races, you see in the Masters documentary when you go out for the 56th yard, the one they didn't finish, you see him actually come up and ask you, do you want me to hang back with you for a while?
I'm not very good at accepting help, and like I don't want someone else to sacrifice their event for me. But it's funny that you say that, because it didn't only happen at the Masters event. Aaron and Rob Parsons did the exact same thing for me at Biggs, because I remember we went out on that 60th loop, and both of them hung back and said, "Come on, mate!" Like. And then I remember Aaron saying, we've got to get into 400 Ks. And it was like, I'm like, man, these guys have been running for 400 kilometers and they're willing to sacrifice that at the world champs. Yeah. So both those guys, you know, next time I'll take that offer, because it's a part of it. I think, you know, you're going to have a moment where you're going to have to accept help from others. And when the opportunity arises, it's probably, you know, it's there for a reason, because if I had have gone with those guys on that 60th loop at that time, it might have got me through a couple more loops, got my mental space going again, and then I could have kept on going. But I suppose I'd like to emulate, you know, those kind of moments and be able to help others. So it was good to be able to do that a couple of times at Mirren, weren't it?
Yeah. On that Masters documentary as well, there's a part when you're being interviewed and you said something like that when you're running a backyard ultra, you never want to do them again. Like, did you have that kind of feeling at Mirren, weren't it, or at all?
No. I think this time around, that moment, and I think it's probably because I didn't get to a point where I felt broken. I managed to get to that point where I think I've spoken to you about it, where, you know, the anticipation of that pain, like, so you'll have that pain at whatever moment it might be, 10 hours in, 15 hours in, and you're always thinking that pain's going to get worse, and it never does. So I got to that point where the pain just wasn't getting worse. I'm like, oh, I'm just doing this over and over and over again. So getting to that point was nice, and I'm like, okay, I've just got to keep doing this. And I think with what I've learned from, you know, being at Biggs and seeing how some of the, you know, real professional guys do it, it's, you can keep going, and you don't, and not wanting to do it again. It actually, yeah, it depends on what your drive is, I suppose. Like my drive was to win. So, yeah, not wanting to do it again never even entered my mind. And even now, like post-race, I'm like, I'm actually keen to go again because, yeah, I felt like I had more to give. But for a change, it's nice for a change to be able to, you know, say that.
Yeah. I remember we had a brief chat on course at the Masters and you told me that you'd recently added caffeine to your race plan and that it had made a big difference to your performance. Did you have a caffeine strategy at Miriam Werner?
Yeah, I did. So my caffeine strategy was like every 4 hours I was having caffeine, but I kind of held off this time around. I've kind of, Kalgoorlie, I've kind of tried to hold off further and further before I start the caffeine strategy. It just seems to, like, I don't feel like I'm a coffee drinker anyway, but I don't feel like it's doing all that much, but it must be doing something because I'm alert. And I think caffeine's meant to help with perceived effort as well. So I was having caffeine probably every 4 hours. But I also, like, I work with a local naturopath, and there's a couple other things that I was taking in conjunction with that to help with, like, you know, the gut brain connection, the health of my gut during the event as well, like a neuro support supplement as well that helps with, you know, we're depleting ourselves of so many nutrients. And my biggest downfall in backyard ultras is that I'll start to hallucinate, and then I think that that's the beginning of the end. I start making irrational decisions, and whereas I felt like all that was switched on the whole time. Like even Rachel, my wife, was saying to me, like, I've never seen you this alert and this switched on the whole time. So having those kind of supplements really, really helped with just feeding my brain the things that it needs to function. So they're not, none of those things are stimulants, but they're more, so the caffeine is the stimulant, but the rest of the stuff is more just to help, you know, feed the gut of things that it needs to function. You know, as you know, the harder you work, all the blood rushes away from your stomach. It doesn't want to work as efficiently. So it was all about kind of, you know, maintaining all those kinds of things, or like the health of my brain and my gut at the same time kind of thing. And I think that's important because I think a lot of people tend to just eat carbs and maybe take caffeine, but there are other things that you can do, even if it's taking a multivitamin or a little bit of extra magnesium and things like that, because, you know, your day-to-day life, you might take a multivitamin in the morning, and then you're racing for 3 days, you don't take a multivitamin, your body's like, hang on, I actually rely on these things just to function, and now you're putting me through hell and you're not even giving me this. So I think it's still important to do those things.
Yeah, I think I saw an Instagram post. You're a big advocate for like a magnesium supplements before bed. Is that right?
Yeah, so I take that pill of magnesium before bed, like every night. So there's a few different things that I take. Like I think, you know, supporting your joint health and things like that with collagen, I think that's important. It always comes down to like how much are you willing to put in and into the running side of things. Like I don't consider myself a pro or anything like that. I have a job. We run a farm. I have a family. You know, the kids have other activities. My wife does horse riding with my daughter and all those other things. So it's always how much you put into something, like, I mean, and what you're going to get out of it. So I try and say to people, you know, like, yes, I take the magnesium and some, you know, other supplements to help me, but it's because I want the most out of my training and recovery. And I think that they're important, but I mean, it's each to their own. You know, we're not it's not a professional sport just yet, but yeah, I try and get the most out of myself with the time that I have to put in.
Yeah, sure. So when I spoke to Joel on the podcast, he got a tattoo to celebrate his MVP win. Are you going to get a Miriam Wernert tattoo, or have you got one?
No, I'm tattoo free. I don't have a single tattoo. So it's almost, yeah, if I did have tattoos, then I would, which I don't have anything against it. I've always thought about getting one, but I always think that as a person, I change so much year on year, and you know, who I was 5 years ago is a completely different person to who I am today. So for me, I'm like, I probably look at it and go, I remember when I was doing World Tough Mudder and everyone was getting World Tough Mudder tattoos and stuff like that, and that they're awesome, and like, you know, they're a cool way to display a memory and stuff like that. But like, if I was looking down at my arm and I had this massive World Tough Mudder tattoo, like some of my achievements since then, you know, definitely trump what I did at World Tough Mudder. But no tattoos just yet, unless I come up with something really cool that you know, that I can kind of settle on. But yeah, at the moment, there's no tattoos.
Yeah, fair enough. So on your Instagram bio, it says that gardening's another one of your passions. And and I mean, since I started running 5 years ago, the amount of energy I had to look after my veggie patch, it's really gone downhill. So, like, when you go berserk and run for like your 200 kilometer weeks and stuff, does your garden take a bit of a hit?
Yes, it does. It's actually nice to have teenage kids. Yeah. Which I kind of write down a list of Ollie, and I'm write a list for Ollie. I'm like, can you please water everything in the greenhouse? Can you please water these garden beds and this and this? And it's pretty cool. I mean, you'll have to come out. I know that you don't live very far away from me, but you'll have to come out and check out how much I've done. And you know, it's nice to especially when everything's, all the trees are fruiting and stuff like that, I'll go out and I'll have breakfast pretty much. You know, I'll pick some, you know, apples or some plums, or you know, you got tomatoes growing in the garden, so I'll end up having breakfast outside, and it's all, you know, fresh and just there. I do enjoy the gardening side of things. It's a nice break away from the running, and just watching things grow and stuff like that. I do tend to get a little bit of philosophical about life in general, but the gardening side of things kind of calms me, I suppose.
Yeah, awesome. So now you've qualified for the Australian team, you don't have to worry about chasing numbers or anything like that to stay on the at large list. Are you going to switch off from backyards for a while and do some other types of races, or what are you going to do?
Yeah, I kind of wanted to take this year as like one event at a time kind of thing. I looked at I'm going off to No Time to Die. I'm going to crew for Ollie and Joel, so hopefully they do really well. I'm looking forward to seeing what Joel can do, because I mean, what he did at MVP was amazing, and how much energy he had left at the end of that event. I know that Miriam Wernert cooked him, but it cooked a hell of a lot of other people as well. Mm-hmm. So I think that Ollie, same as Ollie, I think the only game that he has to work on is probably maybe his mental game a little bit, where, you know, as a kid, he's still kind of like, oh no, I feel sorry for myself, I don't want to be doing this, and just having that ability to pick himself back up, which would be cool. So yeah, crewing for those guys at No Time to Die. I'm going to see how I go for the rest of the week. I just kind of want to go for a few runs and see how I go. But Down Under, 135 again, would be cool. I mean, last year, that was a really big surprise for me just to finish that event. You know, it's 200 plus Ks and 13,000 meters of vert. It's a different style of event to the backyard, but it's so brutal, but it builds so much mental resilience, which is good for kind of backyards. I kind of want to find I enjoy doing events that kind of build that mental stuff. So that's probably my next event. And I do love the point-to-point races. I think that I don't do enough of them. And last year I did so many backyards it's mentally kind of draining when you do it, and having that, you know, that need not to have to do it is nice. So next up, I think it'll be Down Under. But trust me, the allure of Decal Gully and running against Sam and Ryan and James is definitely, that itch is there, but I think Down Under's around there. I'd love to go, but it's the expense of actually going and stuff like that. I've got to be careful because, you know, WA in October is going to be, you know, a little bit expensive to get over there and with the whole family and stuff like that. So, and we got to kind of look at what everyone else is doing in the family in terms of their sports and activities, because everyone's kind of, got their hobbies as well. So we can't just focus on mine.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to seeing how the runners who were a little bit disappointed with their performances at Miramwurrnit bounce back. I reckon Joel's going to do really well at No Time to Die. I reckon Matt Doobie's going to kill it at Wild Dog. I reckon we're going to see some massive PBs from runners from Miramwurrnit.
Oh, for sure. I always look at a like what you learn from an event and what you can gain. And there's always like one thing that stands out for me in every event that I do. And I reckon the one thing that will stand out for all those people that didn't do as well is redemption. They're going to, I seen Ben's post on Instagram and, you know, he was a little embarrassed, you know, that he didn't respect the conditions and stuff like that. And I think that, that everyone that went in there and didn't get what they wanted, that's the one thing that they're going to go, I want redemption. I want to prove to myself that I can get, you know, those big results. And sometimes that's all you need. And you'll, you know, when you, same as for yourself, you go to Wild Dog, you'll hit a massive number and you'll be happy with the achievement that you get at Wild Dog, but you'll be always looking back at Miramwurrnit and going, that's why.
Yeah.
So sometimes everything has to happen for a reason, and you know, maybe that failure is what will drive you towards your next success.
Yeah, 100%. So at the end of each podcast, Tim, I like to get my guests 3 backyard ultra tips. So what would your 3 tips be?
So firstly, I would say, try and mitigate the amount of stress going into an event. I've found that probably my 2 best, you know, successes that I've had in recent years, I've managed to not be as stressed out leading into the event. I do overthink things a lot, but like just not stressing out, just, you know, have a casual setup, you know, just, you know, that stress just feeds the anxiety in your body before you're even, you know, taking off. So try and mitigate how stressed you are about the event. It's not always easy, but try and do that. Have a really good race plan so that your crew can follow along. I think that anyone that I've seen that's kind of come in and, you know, had the potential to go really, really far, their race has fallen apart around about 24 hours because they don't have a plan, you know, whether it be just, you know, a simple nutrition plan of what they think they might need, because at least that way, a lot of people have inexperienced crews. It might be a mum or a brother or a partner that's really never seen an event like this, and they'll turn up with a bag full of Red Bull and V's and think this should do it. And it's like, no, that, you know, you've got to make sure that you've got a plan so that you can kind of, even if it's not followed to a T, it doesn't matter. At least there's something there. And lastly, I think as the community kind of grows, I think that like have fun. Like it is a fun event because you're not on the throttle the whole time, and you know, having fun and talking to the other runners and getting to know them, and you know, you get to know people on quite a personal level because you're all kind of experiencing this shared trauma together. And the longer that you share that trauma together, you'll end up being able to pick each other up and, you know, continue on, because it's not about beating. Like I never even look at it as I'm beating you or I'm always kind of beating myself. And at the end of the day, yes, I might have been the last one standing on this occasion, but that's not always going to be the case. And I think, you know, if you're looking at it to beat everyone, you tend to kind of fall over and you're in your own head too much. Whereas if you're kind of looking at these people as, you know, your friends, then it's just like a casual run with your mates. So I think having fun with them is the most important thing.
Yeah, cool. To your first tip, like not to be too stressed, you definitely looked nice and relaxed the night before the race. You had an awesome little camp set up. You had the tunes playing, you had the fan on. That looked really nice and relaxed.
Yeah, well, that's it. Like, I mean, being an overthinker, I tend to, I can stress out over things that are kind of a little bit out of my control. And that, I suppose the whole stressing thing is as well as like, don't stress about things that you can't control. Like the weather was one thing no one could control, but the bringing fans, bringing ice, being prepared for what the weather was going to bring, was the best way to kind of de-stress, I suppose, because if you focus the whole time about how bad the weather was going to be, well, guess what? That's how bad it was going to be. And it was funny. Ollie said to me when we were running, he goes to me, I love running in the heat. I'm really good in the heat. And then after the race, he's like, oh, Tad, I was lying. I didn't, you know, but he goes, but you said to me that what you put out there is what you're going to get back. So he was kind of channeling that, saying, oh, I'm good in the weather. I'm good. So you're kind of tricking your mind and your body into thinking that I'm okay in this situation. Yeah. So, yeah, kind of saying to yourself that everything's going to be okay, it actually, it's almost like fake it until you make it. And then in the end, you kind of start believing it.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, well done again on the win. I thought I was so impressed with that performance, and Ollie's as well. Really, everyone did well. I mean, even the people who dropped out early. I mean, it was so tough. But to go for 35 hours, that was unbelievable to watch.
Yeah, thank you. Like, I mean, that weather, you know, people on hot days like that, people go for a run first thing in the morning or late at night. No one ever runs in the middle of that heat ever. Even in training, people try and avoid it. And for so many of us to endure it through the day, it was a testament to everyone's endurance and, you know, drive to want to, you know, succeed at that event. So it was, yeah, the Peters put on a great event, and I'm glad that they went ahead with it, because there were times where I think they might have been nervous that it was too hot. But yeah, to their credit, you know, they went ahead with it, and yeah, thankfully everyone made it through okay.
Yeah, awesome. Well, yeah, congratulations. It was an awesome performance, and yeah, thanks for coming on the podcast. It's been awesome.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for having me, Pato.
No worries. I'll speak to you soon.
All right. Catch you, mate.
See you, Tim.
See ya.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, it would be awesome if you could share, comment, like, subscribe, all of that. If you've got any feedback, shoot me a message. Hope you have a great day. See ya.